This is the second tape in a series by Thomas B. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Now, those are just four background notes as far as the picture was concerned. Along with those, I want to mention two principal events that lie in this strange bedfellows thing in the background, or maybe two principal conditions. You can call it what either you like. The first of them is that from about 1760 to 1790, there was a great spiritual dearth in the colonies. It was not a period of spiritual vitality. Now, the Great Awakening had occurred around 1740, 1750. Great revivals are followed by great backsliding. Now, I don't mean it quite that simple, but that's rather the way it goes. So there had been a great revival in the 1740s. It had carried over to the 1750s. In the 1760s, you had a period of spiritual declension set in, which held the colonies very much in its grip until after 1790. You have another great wave of revivals around 1800, a giant wave and movement of the Spirit of God. Consequently, in the days of the Revolution, the spiritual condition was hardly prime. I don't set a lot of material in films, you know. But if you noticed the film last night, the Williamsburg film last night, you must have noticed in the film, and the film is somewhat historic here in its accuracy, you must have noted in the film that when they called for the day of fasting and prayer, it was more a political motif than a spiritual exercise. Now, that was in the film, but there's excellent historic evidence for that. Now, that doesn't negate the fact that spiritual men took part and took part spiritually. But the men who moved it saw it largely as political. Oh, if you don't like the word motif, call it what you like it. Spiritual men joined to it. Washington himself in his diary notes his bowing to pray to God that day. And there's no reason to think of what many spiritual men took part and actually prayed, but the initial thrust, see, was a political... Who could object to men meeting to pray? That's the thrust. If men met to plot a revolution, a lot of people might object, but who could object to men meeting to pray? And where hearts cried out sincerely, certainly God was honored. The second of these concepts is the attitude which is developed towards the motherland, and which I tried to check out a little bit on Monday. Very few people who had been in this country more than a few years thought any longer of England as the motherland. Very few people. Certainly there were some Tories we would call them, but even many of them thought of it as a distant place that they were not interested in going back to. The motherland concept had died. So as I mentioned on Tuesday or Wednesday, whenever it was, when the boys are writing the Declaration of Independence, they never speak of George as our king. It's always their king. It's always them and us. It's never we being bothered by ourselves, but it's those over there and we who are here. In the Declaration of Independence, that is very clear. They have caused our own citizens, says Jefferson, to bear arms against us. Consequently, by the time the Revolution came, there were segments in the country that were very pro-English, but they were small. There was a fairly large segment that didn't really care. The giant segment no longer thought of itself as being part of Great Britain. Now, what I've tried to do here in the strange bedfellows thing is discuss four basic ideas in the background and two principal conditions that prevail. Now, if you can bear with me for a couple minutes, it's never too late to go home, but if you can bear with me for a couple minutes, I wanted to just track out a few lives that were involved in it in very brief detail, the kind of detail you can pick up by yourself in the illustrated comic book thing. Strange bedfellows. I will mention six men. You could mention 66, but I classify them in three groups. The group that is out-and-out Christian, no question, see. You read their diaries and letters, and you think you're reading the last sermon by a fundamental pastor. The group that is out-and-out Christian. You understand what I mean by that. A really born-again group, no questions asked, no holds barred. And then an intermediate group whose religious persuasion you're never really sure of. You read one thing and it sounds good, and you read another thing and you shake your head and wonder what they're talking about. And then a third group, out-and-out non-Christians. Now, I'm wise enough theologically to know that a man is either a Christian or he isn't. There's no middle ground here. But there are some people, God really knows who they are, incidentally. There are some people who are easily and quickly recognized as Christians, and there are some people who are easily and quickly recognized as not. And then there are a great multitude that unless you have real opportunity to be closer, no, we don't know much about. Only God really knows. Strange bedfellows, all of them bound together in the patriotic compact that brought about our liberty. Let me mention a couple who in no sense can be regarded as Christian. In no sense can be regarded as Christian. And yet, mind you, I'm using that from a spiritual point of view. Let me mention Thomas Paine. How's that? Nobody is going to think of him as a Christian, are they? Thomas Paine. Let me mention him first of all. I won't say a lot about him. I don't know a lot about him. I've read four or five books by him. Paine eventually was the citizen of no country, if you get right down to it. Now, Thomas Paine was born in 1737 and died in 1809. You can live your life and be happy forever and not know those dates, but I felt it necessary to say them. His parents were Quakers. He rebelled somewhat against that, not kind of the way people rebel today, but he rebelled against it just the same. In 1774, he came to America. He had not been here before. Came to America in 1774, largely at the invitation of Benjamin Franklin. And so he came to America and edited a newspaper for Franklin for about a year and a half, from mid-1774 till near the end of 1775. While he was doing that, he was the friend, the close friend and confidant of some very fine Christians, David Rittenhouse, the scientist, Benjamin Rush, the physician, and John Witherspoon, the theologian. They spent their nights discussing a lot of things, in addition to his paper, Affairs with England and that sort of thing. 1774 to 1775. He became famous for producing the pamphlet Common Sense. Witherspoon was really the pusher behind it. I will mention Witherspoon a little later, but Witherspoon was really the pusher behind it. Common Sense is simply a pamphlet arguing against the control of the king and in favor of the freedom of the colonies. He followed it by a series of papers entitled The Crisis, and then by a big essay in the latter part of the 1779, I think. I'd hate to take an oath on that, but in the latter part of that decade, a big essay on the public good. He's long been called the pamphleteer of the Reformation. And his material, consequently, was circulated widely up and down the continent. Paine survived the Revolution. And shortly after the Revolution, in the middle 1780s, was sent back to England as kind of an emissary. His idea was that he would persuade England by argument and debate to become a republic rather than a monarchy. It's hard to know what he thought. Paine really opposed the Constitution because the Constitution gave too much government. Hard to know what he would think today. He was really closer to an anarchist almost than anything else, and yet in that sense. But in England, he was soon persona non grata. They locked him up for a little while. They're going to charge him with treason. He escaped and slipped off to France, where he joined in the forces rallying for the French Revolution. He wrote a lot of pamphlets for them. Paine was a learned fellow. He spent a lot of time in a French jail because Robespierre became afraid of him and locked him up. If Robespierre had lived another month, they might have executed Paine. But Robespierre himself was guillotined and Paine was free. While in France, he wrote the famous Age of Reason. He said that he wrote the Age of Reason, which is the great agnostic work at best. He said he wrote the Age of Reason as a reaction against the French superstition, which was ruining the lives of the people. He saw France as a great battleground of superstition in which the church had used its mythical powers to harass the people. And so he wrote the Age of Reason largely to the French people. It was almost immediately translated and published in this country. It was published in America under the sponsorship of Thomas Jefferson. The Age of Reason was supposed to end supernatural speculation. It did not do Paine any good in this country or in Europe, really. It didn't convert many Christians to agnosticism. It earned him a bad name. And when he returned to this country after the French Revolution, although he had certain honors, he never really was in good standing. When he died about 1813, or 1809 rather, he was hardly missed. And in 1819, his bones were taken back to England, where they are to this day. He was never really a citizen of any place, if you know what I mean by that. A pamphleteer, a satirist, a man interested in the greatest expression of personal freedoms with the least possible control thereof. And yet, like it or not, he's one of the moving forces in the Reformation. I'm sorry, the Revolution. He had nothing to do with the Reformation. One of the moving forces in the Revolution. Now, it's easy to overestimate what he did, so you can't do that. But he's one of the moving forces. He's one of the men that George III wanted hung more than anybody else. Along with him, Witherspoon. See, he would have hung this fine Christian preacher and this atheist on the same, or agnostic, really. Paine is not an atheist, but he would have hung them together on the same day, one right after the other, or both at the same time, if possible. But Paine is clearly in that non-Christian bracket. The other man that I'll mention in that bracket is Thomas Jefferson, whom I admire in many ways. But theology is not one of them. But I admire him in many ways. Jefferson is to be commended for much that he thought. Now, Jefferson was born in 1743, so he was 6 years younger than Paine, but he lived until 1826. Jefferson was a man of law, a lawyer who hated the profession and went into politics and farming as soon as he could. He only practiced law a couple of years and never really returned. 1769, he was in the House of Burgesses in Virginia. Jefferson hated public debate. He said it accomplished nothing. The big arguments, he said, were lost on the multitudes. And he was more in favor of what we would call today mind-bending through getting six or seven fellows together where a man with strong will gets his own way by forceful personality. We have a technical term for that. What do we call that? The what? No, there's a better term than that. Can't think what it is. It doesn't make a lot of idea. But that was his idea. His idea was, why debate in public? Why argue in Congress? Jefferson gave almost no speeches all times in the House of Burgesses. It was an exercise in futility, he thought. Better to sit down with some guy and argue it out man to man, just the two of you, than there was some hope of making your point. At least if he left, your forceful personality would burn in his mind. Now, Jefferson, of course, is the author, largely, of the Declaration of Independence. He worked with five other men. He kind of thought that Lee should write it, but he is largely the author of the Declaration of Independence, and it's one of those things for which he's remembered in his epitaph, the Declaration of Independence. In 1801, he was elected president of the country, but it was an election by Congress, not by the public. He actually had a plurality of public vote, but in the House, the votes were equal for him and Aaron Burr. It fell to Alexander Hamilton to decide the final vote on it, and Hamilton cast his vote to Jefferson, and Jefferson was elected on the basis of Hamilton's vote. Aaron Burr never got over it, you know. And a few years later, when Hamilton challenged him to a duel, Burr shot straighter, or whatever. He was good. He practiced for hours. A long time in getting over it. Whatever the particular case happens to be, Jefferson was elected. Under Jefferson's administration, the Louisiana Purchase was made and the country grew tremendously. Jefferson was a man who really believed, honestly, I think, in a government of laws, as I was trying to say Tuesday, with maximum freedom as the laws will allow. He was not like Paine. He was by no means anarchical at all. He thought that the people had to form a government and that that government then would have to be responsive to those people. He, too, had a tough time with the federal Constitution for a while because he thought it was allowing and giving too much liberty to an overall body rather than to the individual segments of it. But he came to accept it in time. Let me say no more about these men. The Jefferson Bible is still in print. I mentioned it the other day. You can see what Jefferson did with the Scripture by printing what he thought was really what we needed and leaving out just about everything that's redemptive, or almost. He was a gentleman. As I said the other day, he always spoke with courtesy of the deity, although that isn't the thing that saves you either, but he did it just the same. And when he died, he asked to be remembered for the three things. One, that he was the author of the American Declaration of Independence. Two, that he was the prime mover of the religious freedom statute in the state of Virginia. And three, that he was the father of the University of Virginia. He wanted to be remembered as a defender of independence, as a man who sought religious freedom for all, and as an educator, which is noteworthy. But both Jefferson and Paine had one great thing in common, and that is a lack of any kind of confidence in Jesus or any real trust in the God of the Bible. Let me mention two intermediate lives. Depends on how you look at these guys, but if you read six books, you'll get 14 different ideas. So let me mention two intermediate ones. Now, I'll mention, there are hundreds of lives, and I do not know them all, but I'll mention Patrick Henry as Exhibit A. Some men make Henry look like a total atheist. Others make him look like one of the great saints. And as I've said sometimes, a part of the church has been saving Nebuchadnezzar for years while the other part condemns him. Those things you'll have to figure out on your own, but Henry at least is a questionable type. In my own mind, George Washington is much, much clearer in testimony than Henry. But Henry, from time to time, says great things, and good things are said about him. Henry was born in 1736 and died in 1799. He was always a big talker, and the attempts of his father to get him started in business and farming and commerce failed repeatedly. He had failed three times before he succeeded at anything, and his success came when he entered the bar. After 1760, he was an attorney, and for most of his practicing years, a criminal attorney. He gained great fame in 1763. The English Parliament had passed a law, you know, in Virginia, Henry lives, of course, but they had a law that the preachers were paid in tobacco, and you could take that the preacher would then send the tobacco to England and sell it in the market, and that would be his income. I don't mean he was paid totally in tobacco, but each tobacco grower under the establishment system that prevailed in Virginia, each farm would pay a certain share of his tobacco to the preacher, the local parish priest. The Virginia House acted a law contrary to that, in which they pronounced that in a year when the tobacco crop was deemed poor, the clergyman could be paid just with money, not with tobacco. Of course, the irony of it was if they paid him with tobacco, he might send it to Europe and sell it for three times as much. And the British House overruled that. It's known as the Parsons Act. And in the case of the Parsons Act, Henry argued strongly in favor of the fact that you ought to be allowed to pay the preacher money. You shouldn't have to pay him tobacco. If it's a poor year, you might need to smoke it yourself in January to stay warm. And he gained great fame for his rhetoric through taking up unpopular causes like that. And he espoused in particular what is known as the law of natural rights. A man has certain natural rights. Henry's contribution to the independence thing, incidentally, through Jefferson, are rather pronounced. But there is a law of natural rights, he said. And one of those natural rights is for a man to possess and dispossess of his own goods. If he raises the tobacco, he ought to be able to know what to do with it. The law of natural rights. After 1766, he was in the Virginia House and a regular worker with the Revolutionary Congresses. Henry himself was governor of Virginia for a couple years, commander of the Virginia militia for a period of time. When the war was over, he was quite opposed to the Constitution because, again, he thought that it centralized authority too much. But the Bill of Rights placated Henry, and he died at peace with the Constitution. He felt that the Bill of Rights had given the man freedom again. When it comes down to religious matters, Henry is a man who speaks respectfully and hard to know what to say. He came from a very spiritually minded family, and maybe when he says good things, they're just what he learned as a kid in catechism class. Hard to know, but he certainly is a question mark. It's quite popular for liberals to look at Henry and call him a liberal. Now, one should be careful with that. One should be careful with it. He certainly is at least a question mark. The other man I'll mention is John Hancock, who is perhaps a little more definite in a Christian type of sense than Henry, but likewise not as firm as people like myself would like him to be. The problem we face, I think, is that I would like everybody to sound like I sound. I don't sound that good, but what I mean by that is I'd like them all to say, yes, I'm born again. I was converted on such and such a date, and here's how I know, and then give John 5:24 and so forth. Well, not everybody expresses himself that way. John Hancock would live from 1737 to 1793. He was a radically minded fellow. He was not, at least when they blockaded the port of Boston, he said they would smuggle. When they put taxes on, smuggling was better. He would have been running a mafia ring in his day, if necessary. He said anything was better than paying that which was illegitimate or illegal. And he regarded all of the taxes put on the Boston port and imports that were not placed there by the city itself. He regarded them all as strictly illegal and advocated smuggling to bypass them. He was the first real president of the Continental Congress in 1775 and again through 1777, and he had previously been the president of the Provisional Congress 1774 and 1775. He's the chap who wrote his name large. Whether he really said he'd write it so George could read it without his pipe, no one really knows about that. But he wrote it large on the Declaration of Independence. That insurance company has been using it ever since, or at least up until recently. I don't know what they're doing these days. Hancock is a questionable fellow. Like Samuel Adams, not John, but like Samuel Adams, Hancock, apart from his radicalism, often makes many statements that sound evangelical. But when he's talking about other acts, then you wonder. But he's not a Paine or a Jefferson. You see a difference there. I had thought originally to read you copiously from the diaries and notes of these men, but then I said, Thomas, it's a short afternoon. Every library, I'll name the men, every library contains copious stuff. I'd like to mention two men, then, who are just simply outright believers. They are representative of a group, outright believers, with no questions asked, no apologies given. There were many such. There were many such in all groups in the Revolution. That's why we call it strange bedfellows. Some Christians were not in favor of the Revolution. Most of the Low Country people, most of the Mennonites and whatnot, were neither pro or con. They didn't believe in warfare, and they'd just as soon not be disturbed. Now, some Mennonites were Toryish. They mostly went to Canada in due time. But mostly, they were a leave-us-alone, we'll-leave-you-alone group. But among the Presbyterians and the Baptists, revolutionaries ran 10-1 against loyalists, at least 10-1. The Methodists struggled for a while. Many of the Episcopalians were loyal to the king. Virginia lost many of its preachers during the Revolution. Many of its parishes shrunk by over two-thirds during the Revolution. Many of its preachers went back to England. Many of its schools closed. Presbyterians and Baptists, there were some exceptions to that. There were a few fiery Episcopalians around Philadelphia who reconstituted the church after the Revolution. They were fiery fellows, and they could have finished Patrick Henry's statement, George III, when they cried treason, treason, and we'll never know for sure what Henry was going to say. But he said in George III, you know, Caesar had his Brutus and so forth. George III, he said, may profit by their example when the crowd cried treason. We'll never know for sure what he planned to say before the house began to yell, treason, treason. Maybe that's what he planned all along. We'll never know. But whatever the particular case happens to be, there were some Episcopalians who were very much in favor of the Revolution. Many were not. Many were loyal to England because, among other things, their stipend was guaranteed by the king. That sometimes helps you a little bit. But I mentioned two fervent and zealous Christians. I mentioned, first of all, John Witherspoon, a prominent Presbyterian minister, John Witherspoon, who lived from 1723 to 1794, came to this country about 1768. He was a Scots clergyman, but he was a resident of the country long before he came here, if you know what I mean. His sympathies were with the colonies and with freedom from the oppression of the crown. He was a Scots clergyman. The Scots could still remember the attempt of the second cob of the English grouping under Charles II to suppress Presbyterianism. They could remember it very well and plainly. Witherspoon was not a revolutionary in the sense that Paine was. But he by no means thought that believed in the divine right of kings or any such thing. In 1768, he became the president of what was known as the College of New Jersey, today known as Princeton University. The College of New Jersey was the logical successor to the Log College, which was built here in Pennsylvania about 1726. Around 1748, they began operating in New Jersey. In 1768, it was formalized. Witherspoon became the first president. He was also the former of the first General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church and became its first moderator. As I said a moment ago, he's the only clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence. He is one of the men that George III referred to when he thought that the Presbyterian clergy, the pulpits of the Presbyterian clergy, were the hotbeds of sedition and treason. Yet, if you read Witherspoon's sermons, Witherspoon, his complete works were published in 8 volumes originally. I have a 4-volume set in which they were packed together, and the print is so small you can hardly read it. But if you read Witherspoon's sermons, they are great preaching. He was a godly man. His vote was cast with the idea of maximum freedom under law, but a godly man. He felt that the king had no authority to colonize to start with. That's it. He went all the way back to 1607, see, and said the king has no authority to colonize to start with. People do the work, not the king. If the king wanted to come and live here, that would be another matter. Let him come and farm a patch in the country. He had no right to colonize in the first place, no right to submit others in the second place, a whole group of things like that. Witherspoon was the preacher extraordinary of the parliamentary congresses. Of the constitutional congresses in this country. I ought to mention also the man whose house you saw in Philadelphia the other day. He's less known, but perhaps one of the most emphatic Christians and revolutionary thing, Elias Boudinot, B-O-U-D-I-N-O-T, Elias Boudinot, not so well known, who lived from 1740 to 1821. Did you see his house, Dr. Newman, the head house?
We weren't sure.
Oh.
We were right this spot.
I see.
The
I'm sorry, the head house is a tavern today with that name on it. Yeah. That's the original home that Boudinot lived in. It's come on evil days. But that's the original home. If you'd like to travel through Philadelphia and spend a lot of money, the museum, which I also had noted you might look at the corner of, the man full of sorrows. Did you see the corner of that thing? The tavern museum? No, you got that for him. You just weren't used there. Well, you can't see everything. But anyhow, Boudinot is a very, very fervent Christian. He, too, was an attender of the convention. He was not a clergyman, however. He was a businessman. He was an attender of the Constitution of the conventions. He was president of the Continental Congress in 1882 and 1883. Among other things, in his diary, there's a long account on his talking to George Washington about the reality of conversion and belief on Jesus Christ. It's a fascinating thing to read. Oh, I mean, it would sound like something written today, but, you know, it's a fascinating thing to read. His concern for Washington's soul. As I remember, I didn't look at it today, it's been a couple months ago, as I remember, Boudinot did not make the assumption that Washington was lost. But he was mighty concerned that he be sure of what his circumstance was. So he really worked the gospel backwards and forwards, you might say. He was director of the U.S. Mint from 1795 and was the first president a few years later of the American Bible Society. When Paine's Age of Reason came out and Jefferson translated in this country, Boudinot immediately wrote a book entitled The Age of Revelation, which was to answer the Age of Reason. There's a considerable difference between ability. Being a Christian does not always guarantee that you'll be the best writer. And so Boudinot's impress was somewhat less, maybe. But his fervency and zeal were very plain. So what I have done here simply is to mention 6 lives. So you could magnify it. You could add Franklin to the unbelievers list, Washington to the in-between list, although I think the evidence is much stronger that Washington knew the Lord. But he could have. You could add men backwards and forwards, up and down. But I merely mentioned 6 as being representative of the strange bedfellows. And yet they were all bound together in one great common cause. Now, the tendency we face often in history is to look back at all of them and either make them all Christians. I attended a banquet one night at which a prominent brother made all of them Christians. He excused Benjamin Franklin for his statements about the lack of deity in Jesus. He did that because he said Franklin didn't understand. And the Lord knows the hearts, incidentally, but he made them all Christians. Everybody in the Green Mountain Boys, who were nothing but a band of thugs before the Revolution, stealing furs, was suddenly an apostle and a missionary. The chief problem with that is that it glamorizes history, and when people find out it isn't quite that way, then they sometimes swoop the other way. On the other hand, the modern liberal texts make everybody look like a free-thinking liberal who had no principles at all. You'd think that everybody in the Revolution, if you read the modern histories, was either a bounder, a cad, or a liberal, enlightened man. You'd kind of get that feeling. And what I've said this morning is, or this afternoon, is the truth is very much in between that. In the founding of this country as a nation, not as a colony of England, but in the birth of this country as a nation, you had a rare combination of men who loved the Lord Jesus and men who denied that he ever meant anything, and a large group who didn't know what to think and were caught in that big quasi-think. They are the formers of the nation. Strange bedfellows. When the revolution was over, many of them could hardly speak peaceably to each other again. Witherspoon denounced Jefferson for his religious ideas. But for the time of the revolution, they were strange bedfellows who worked on a common cause. Now that leads me to a couple of summary notes. Strange bedfellows. I've said that about 88 times, but I've thought it 1,000 times. I've thought of how hard it was for me in the Army to find out that the guy I had to bunk with was a Mormon for 2 weeks. I survived and he survived, but I remember it, see, pretty well. He was a pretty strict one, too. Of course, they all had in their ID tags LDS, Latter-day Saints. I had to wear Protestant on mine. They wouldn't put my denominational name down, so called me Protestant. I felt rather miffed that a sectarian should have his own initials on his ID tag. I remember I've hardly been miffed in my whole life, really, but I remember the curious feeling, see. He was a good Mormon in diet, but he was not a good Mormon in church practice. And my guess is he had not seen the temple for years before and has not seen it since, except maybe in pictures in National Geographic. That would be my guess. But I remember the strange feeling, see, in that situation. So we were in this little pup tent for about 2 weeks together. Pup tents are not big, and some men have spent months in them in battle gear, but just 2 weeks, see, in this little pup tent. And this little pup tent in 2 weeks, I remember him saying, well, he said, if I hear anything coming after you, he said, I'll try to help you. He wasn't going to let a poor Christian just be carried off in the night by a prowling bear. And I said, yeah, Herbert, I said, if I hear anything coming after you, I'll try to help you. I said, a covenant, see, in the dark of the night, out in the western desert, thinking that an armadillo might steal your socks.
A covenant that you have to watch out for in that kind of a situation.
So when I think about the whole thing of strange bedfellows, it lets me make a few summary remarks. The first of them is just this, that common cause overcomes personal difference. Now you have to be careful with terms like common cause. They are glittering generalities, but common cause overcomes personal difference, even on really important matters. See, the ship is sinking, and the captain says, we got to bail it out. You don't look up and say, I'm not going to bail out with that unbeliever. If there's nobody, if there are no other saved people here to bail, I'm not going to bail. Common cause overcomes personal difference. But I note three things about the cause. It must, first of all, be very plain and specific. It must be very plain and specific. It can't be a nebulous or vague thing. It must be very plain and specific and bold enough that it is common cause to all men, all men involved in the thing. And secondly, it has to be central. Central enough that all of life seems to hang on it. It's got to be plain, it's got to be central enough that all of life seems to hang on it. And third, it must not be encumbered with a number of side issues which obscure the plainness of the main one. I hate to bug you with a lot of details, but common cause, that's strange bedfellows, working together in common cause. Now, the common cause overcomes personal differences, but the common cause has got to be plain enough that its importance is apparent to all, central enough that all feel dependent on it, and it has to be unencumbered enough by minor things that people do not squander their energy fighting on it. See, every now and then somebody says, why don't all of us Christians get together and do something? See, well, the problem is that we can't agree on common cause, believe it or not. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just telling you what the problem is. Because common cause to one group will be saving souls. Common cause to another will be establishing the glory and sovereignty of God. Common cause to another will be building bigger movements. And so somebody will say, why can't we lay aside our differences and work? The big problem is common cause. In the Horsham Bible Church, that's not terribly far from here. The Horsham Bible Church, my wife a couple weeks ago talked to a lady who had just come back from visiting her friends, her relatives in Russia. Just come back is within the last year. How's that? See, preachers' minds are rough, but in the last year. She has a sister and brother who live in Stalingrad, another sister in Moscow, and a couple other places. They were all Estonians one time, then white Russians, then Russians proper, whatever the case happens to be. And she was really infuriated because a missionary fellow had come by recently telling about the religious liberty that he had observed in Russia. So he had been there one Sunday, and he was telling about the religious liberty he had observed, how he'd gone to a church and it was full and whatnot. This lady had my wife in a corner. You can hardly understand her English because it's mostly Russian. She said, yeah, she said, it's full. She said, it's full every Sunday. She said, it's the only church open for 5 million people. Anybody wants to go, goes there. She said, it's full every Sunday. And she says, if it's not full of people who belong, she said, it's full of informers and police. She said, well, she said, they see to it that it's full. So she said, American know-it-alls can see a full church. And then she went into eloquency about various things and pointed out that many of her relatives had been arrested in the last year and how she had slipped this New Testament with fear and trembling to her sister. It's an interesting narrative. And you have to remember that, again, every question has two sides, but an interesting narrative. Now, her conclusion when I said, well, is there any, she said, there's no kind of freedom at all like we know. She said, there is the freedom to be arrested and to give a great testimony in jail. She said, there's that freedom. She said, that freedom is available every day. But she said, as we know it, she said, there's no freedom. Now, see, there are all kinds of people. I was just gripped by talking to her at that particular time and under that particular occasion. So I mentioned to her reading Solzhenitsyn one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich and about the Christians that he describes in prison. And she said, yes, she had never been in prison. She fled to this country after about 1956. She said that in a measure is right. She said her brother told her that in prison, there were no theological arguments and no disagreements among the believers, she said. But common cause, see, survival and testimony. Now, if the war ended, I mean, if the persecution ended in 15 years, they would probably have exactly the same circumstance. We have other places. For there they have common cause keeping each other alive, believe it or not. Because somehow you don't give much of a, you don't pass out tracts or breathe words of testimony when you're dead. So what I'm saying here is that you have a strange bedfellow situation, not really normative. There's a matter of common cause, and that common cause overcomes personal difference. And the big problem we run into in evangelical Christianity is the matter of identifying common cause that will dominate personal difference. And to some, common cause is just buying more buses for the Sunday school. Who's got the most? And I hate to elaborate on that, and so I won't. The second thing I'll note in summary is that when the common cause cannot be established, when it can't be established, then a binding of forces or an agreement of personalities can hardly be achieved. When the common cause cannot be established, then the binding of forces or agreement of personalities can hardly be achieved. Oh, we get along together. I agree for you to go your way, and you agree for me to go my way. And when I get to church on Sunday, I make sure that I note your errors in my sermon. And in your parish, you make sure you note my errors in your sermon. We warn the people about each other because, see, our idea of common cause is he's wrong and I'm right. When we all agree on that, we'll have something to stand for. So when common cause cannot be established, the binding of forces or coalition of personalities cannot be achieved. We had in this country, it's painful history today, but we had in this country for a long time great common cause among fundamentalists. With regard to the National Council and liberal movements, we had great common cause. They were threatening our right to have chaplains and other things and radio programs, and we enjoyed, Mr. Pinckney is with us, he's closer to these things maybe than I am, but we enjoyed great common cause among much the fundamental group. But some of that has been lost, don't you think, through the fragmentation of what the cause was. And when the cause became less plain and less clear, then the personalities emerged and the differences emerged with them.
So what I'm saying is that if the common cause can't be established, then the strange bedfellows don't get in the same bed. They will war with each other. The third summary note is this. In the case of common cause, personal differences aren't sacrificed. Witherspoon never compromised a conviction of the faith that he held, to my knowledge, in the Revolution. Now, personal differences in common cause are not sacrificed, but they are surrendered temporarily. They are surrendered temporarily because the ultimate goal is more important than the establishment of one's own immediate situation. As far as I know, Whitfield never compromised or gave up a theological note for the benefit of Paine or Jefferson. But, he didn't get up in the pulpit in Princeton and warn the people that these were wicked and evil men who could not be trusted in anything. Ironically, when the war was over, he took that position. And he was right to do so. The common cause had been achieved. And the men who had stood together to free themselves from the king now had to establish themselves as free men with maximum legal freedom one towards the other. When the war was over, Witherspoon recognized the fallacy in Jefferson's logic and his religious structures and was quick to point it out. So, in common cause, you don't give up personal differences. You surrender them temporarily. And then a fourth summary note, which is cryptically said. But while the war is on, you attack chiefly the foe. That's what you learn in matters of strange bedfellows. When the war is on, you attack chiefly the foe. We suffer a lot in Christianity. I don't mean to meddle in it. We suffer a lot in Christianity because we spend a lot of time attacking each other. I am not now talking about modernists and compromisers and new evangelicals, just good, honest, Bible-believing Christians. We spend a lot of time attacking each other. Last year, I received at least 5 pieces of literature in which one Christian attacked another over the tribulation and the rapture, and I did not receive 1 piece in which some Christian attacked the devil for atheism or agnosticism, although many are written like that. Many are written like that. People just don't send those things to me. Now, it's right to teach what you believe to be the truth. I don't doubt that for a moment, see, but there is a way to teach and a way to preach, and there's another way to reach out and bash one another. I was telling, I guess it was the, I don't know if it was the congregation up at Ithaca or what, but I got carried away with one of these wild tales of adventure when I was a student or when I was a teacher at Faith Seminary, and we used to have an event where the students and the faculty played softball. We had a student who was a very gifted softball player. He played shortstop. He was one of those guys who could rifle a ball sitting down. He was very gifted. Some of my colleagues would know him yet today. But like myself, he was a big mouth type. The only difference was I was not gifted. They put me always in right field where no balls would be hit. There was a big hill at Faith, and any ball that came up rolled back to the infield anyway. So they put me up there where I could do little damage. But I had a big mouth, and I could stand up there and yell. And when we were at bat, I would go out along the third baseline and yell at this shortstop and other people crudities, not nastyisms, but crudities. Like if I had bowed legs like that, I'd ride pigs instead of playing ball, see? Other witticisms. This shortstop could not refrain from arguing with me. He just couldn't do it. Of course, in a ball game, it isn't professor and student, it's buddies. He couldn't refrain from doing it. I'd look out and I would say something impugning his ability. He was an excellent player. He could not resist the temptation to talk back. And I would like to tell you, we got many a ball by him because he was arguing when he should have been playing ball. It was a ruinous game. I'm not notably proud of it today. We always lost. We had to do something to salvage our ego. We always lost. Sometimes 30-1, 12-1/2. But I've always remembered it as a key example. When the war is on, you attack only the foe. And you make sure that you keep your attention where you're going, see. Great differences, Paine, Franklin, Witherspoon. But when the war is on, you concentrate on the foe. Then let me mention one final summary note. Now, the presence of common cause in itself does not justify the position of a man who takes it.
The fact that a man stands in the same trench and fights with a believer on either side of him does not make that man a saint, nor does it make the believer a sinner. Common cause obliterates those things. Not in God's sight, I mean in our sight. A saint is still a saint because he believes in Jesus. A sinner is a sinner because he doesn't. But the fact that a man who doesn't believe anything suddenly gives great sums for a great common cause of truth will not save him. His being in the cause does not make him right. Nor necessarily does being in the cause make the Christian wrong. In Philadelphia several years ago, they suggested a bill when Mayor Tate was mayor. It was only played with for about 2 days, but they suggested a bill on legalizing prostitution. It was played with for about 2 days. One of my fundamentalist friends said to me quickly, he said, well, he said, I certainly hope, he said, the Philadelphia Council of Churches, that's the liberal group, he said, I certainly hope they don't come out against it tonight. Because, he said, if they come out against it tonight, he said, we couldn't do what they do. He said, we'd have to come out for it tomorrow. He said, how would that look? Now, he was joking with me, but in a measure, he was not far from the mentality of some. Not far from it. I've known some folks that when we'd have a big issue, they'd look down a petition list and they'd see the name of somebody they didn't like and would think that they could not be signatory to something. Well, you don't want to compromise the faith, but common cause, when it's clear and plain and vital enough, doesn't ruin your position and doesn't justify his. Well, what I'm harassing you about this afternoon is this matter of strange bedfellows, sketching a little of the spiritual background of the Revolution, a little of some of the men who were in it to show the different classifications, and noting these three things, or these five summary points. It's hard to apply them to the church in our day and age. Our concept of common cause today is a difficult one. If the country suddenly became totalitarian and we were threatened with extermination or persecution, then the concept of common cause would raise itself quickly. But it will not in the present structure. When I run into someone who says, well, our whole purpose is to win souls, and that's what our common cause has got to be, I don't see that as common cause. See, I see it as a great thing to witness and to win, but I don't see it as common cause. And there's so many people hardly understand what you mean by winning souls. I see a grander thing. I'm caught more with the Reformed concept of common cause. But many of my non-Reformed friends don't like it either. So in our present structure, we are not likely to have a common cause in our religious world of such a force and nature that they had in the days of the Revolution. But if totalitarianism came, then it would be there. I'll just guarantee you. If suddenly a totalitarian government took over and we were all thrown into prison and suddenly it looked like the church was going to be wiped out, you would never ask the fellow next to you whether he spoke in tongues or not. You would never do it, I will just guarantee you. Not that you're wrong to. Do you understand what I'm saying there? It's just that until common cause is sufficient to banish personal differences, we will continue to exercise them. And that's the beauty of this country. It's a free country, and we are free to do so. But we still ought to keep our eyes open to areas of common cause where we can work for truth. I wanted to say one final note with regard to the whole American history scene. This is my country, and I love it. And I always get that lump in my throat in the parades and in the thinking about it. I recognize that godly men came here, and many worked for it. But I recognize at the same time that many came and worked for it who weren't godly at all. Hence, I neither glamorize it nor debunk it. I want to take it for what it is. And where godly men worked, and the things that they worked, and the things they produced, we want to honor and continue them. And if things have been done that are wrong, we want to see them corrected if possible, and adjusted. But when it comes to history, we neither glamorize it nor do we deflate it. We have to come to take it where it is. And the first thing you'll discover is that John Witherspoon was a great, wonderful Christian who stood absolutely for the gospel and the word of God. And a man with whom he worked closely for years, Benjamin Franklin, was very, very far from Christian. Very, very far. But on common cause, it didn't bother Witherspoon. Witherspoon, however, at the right moment, could tell him that he was lost. See, at the right moment, he could tell him that he was lost. But he didn't stand arguing over it while the king's soldiers were at bayonet length. Hope you don't think that's weak of Witherspoon or weak of Franklin. But that's what common cause does. It makes strange bedfellows. Years ago in the service, I was stationed at Fort Hood. I was never in a battle. I was one of those fellows who every time they were about to send him to battle, the government reassigned me to a peaceful area. I never asked, they just push you, they say go and you go, but I never cried too much either. So I was never in a battle, only shot at when hunting rabbits in California by a fellow who thought that my ears looked like those of, you know, that sort of thing. But down at Fort Hood, there were 60,000 men at Fort Hood, and they were soon going to swell it to 240,000 men. 240,000 men for a big maneuver. I met a Christian fellow one night at the PX. He had a Bible with him, and so I asked him if he was a Christian. He said he was, and I asked him if he was born again. He said he was that too. See, that's nice to know. And so I told him I was a believer. And he said, you know, he said, there are lots of men here that don't know the Lord, he said. That was obvious. There were soon going to be another 180,000 of them. He said, a few of us, he said, are meeting at the chapel to pray on Saturday nights that we can be a testimony. He said, we don't have any organization, and he said, we don't have any group, but he said, we're praying for each other that we can be a testimony here. So the following Saturday night, I went to the post chapel where these fellows prayed. That's all they did. They prayed. If you want to stay and argue theology, you could do that, but they prayed, and they prayed for one thing, that they could be a testimony to somebody. And then, of course, that led to praying for Mabel's aunt, too, you know, from time to time. Anything could be mentioned, but they prayed that they could be a testimony to somebody and that the Lord would reach people. Now, the prayer meeting on Saturday nights often went from 7 to 11, and it was all a kneeling session. I would have never believed I could have knelt so long, but they were gripped, see, by the emotion of a 250,000 men, only a handful of whom were Christians. Now, the first night I was there, when we sang a hymn, and then we just turned and prayed, turned and knelt and prayed. I was trapped between a holiness boy from West Virginia and a Reformed Presbyterian fellow from Geneva, Pennsylvania, the old psalm-singing group. And I remember the ecstasy of that moment, or whatever you call it. The fellow from West Virginia amened 1,000 times, praised the Lord 700. He could say hallelujah if somebody coughed in the middle of a prayer. And I must say that at first my attitude was very critical. The fellow from Western Pennsylvania, he never went said amen, hallelujah, or praise the Lord. He didn't even smile. Grimace. Serious brother. I must say that at first, but then I was struck by the irony of the situation. I was struck by the irony of the situation that here, just for a few moments, the common cause was bigger than the reserve of the man from Western Pennsylvania, bigger than the emotiveness of the fellow from West Virginia, and bigger than the personal likings of Tommy Taylor, just for a few moments. Now, we weren't going to form a church, and we weren't going to hold a big campaign. Eventually, a lot of good things came individually. We were going to pray for one thing. From the Revolution, you learn that if the common cause is big enough, then men may voluntarily surrender some of their personal differences for a little season. They can pick them up when the issues are over.